Good morning again. The court calls United States v. Balan. Counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Lieutenant Torin Mishovic and I represent Petty Officer Balan, the appellant in this court, in this case. Chief Judge Baker, with your permission, I request 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Grant.
This court should overturn appellant's conviction to charge one because this plea wasn't knowing and voluntary for three reasons. First, indecent acts was not expressly or constructively charged. Second, this record of trial fails to establish waiver. And third, being convicted of an offense not charged is materially prejudicial. Now, I'd like to start the argument with the first prong, the failure to refer indecent acts. The government's argued that the pretrial agreement constructively referred indecent acts. It didn't. The pretrial agreement merely allowed the appellant to plead guilty to the LIO of rape, which is clearly shown on the pretrial agreement itself, which says not guilty of rape, but guilty to the LIO. But indecent acts is not an LIO of rape. Thus, there's no reason for the pretrial agreement to have constructively altered the charge. This case is distinguished from United States v. Wilkins. In Wilkins, the convening authority made the personal decision to refer a new charge, as received stolen property was not an LIO of larceny. But in this case, the convening authority was wrong about the law. He was under the assumption that indecent acts was an LIO, which it's not. Therefore, there's no reason for the convening authority to refer the charge because under his assumption it was already properly referred before the court. However, if this
court... If that was his assumption, even if he was wrong, doesn't that go to Chief Judge Baker's earlier question about what is the purpose behind all this? And if the purpose behind all this is that the convening authority has the charges he wants before the court-martial, if he thought that the charge he wanted was before the court-martial and he just happened to be wrong as a matter of law, how does that divest the court-martial jurisdiction?
Well, Your Honor, in Wilkins, this court said that it was the convening authority's personal decision to refer a charge. It's his decision to decide what charge before the court. If he's under the wrong assumption, and the pretrial agreement specifically shows that, then the charge is not properly before the court.
But here he's wrong about whether it's an LIO or not, not wrong about the charge, correct?
That's correct.
Isn't that a difference? It's not silent. He's trying to do something.
Yes, Your Honor. However, so if this court does find that that the convening authority did constructively charge indecent acts, then in this case, this pretrial agreement failed to provide adequate notice of the new charge and also alternative theories of liability. As this court said in United States v. Medina, when pleading guilty to a distinct charge, the military judge or the charge sheet must provide adequate notice of alternative theories of liability, which is exactly what happened in United States v. Wilkins. In Wilkins, the military judge put the accused on notice that there was a new charge before his court, and the accused consented to going forward on the court martial. Here, that didn't happen. We don't receive fair notice until we get to Prosecution Exhibit 9, the stipulation of fact. And this court's never held that fair notice could come from a prosecution exhibit, which is accepted into the record after the accused pleads. Therefore, there's no because the convening authority did not intend to refer indecent acts, and also because this pretrial agreement failed to provide adequate notice, the only charge before the court is rape, and thus the appellant
rape and its LIOs.
Yes, Your Honor,
which indecent acts isn't as a matter of law, but which obviously the convening authority was under the impression was.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that goes to the alternative.
Well, it goes to jurisdiction, doesn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Potentially it does.
Okay.
What, in your view, was the LIO that could have been charged or referred as of today?
Assault consummated by a battery, Your Honor.
And what is the sentence potential for that?
There's a difference of 5 years. The indecent acts had a max confinement of 7 years, and the assault consummated by a battery has a max confinement of 2 years.
2 years. And as you read the PTA and the pleas, is it your view that the CA was attempting to refer the LIO to rape or an LIO to rape?
Yes, Your Honor. That would be what's clearly shown on the pretrial agreement itself, and it's speculative, but potentially the convening authority, all we know is that he thought rape was too much, and he just went down the list to the next one. However, he went to the wrong one, and he should have gone to...
Leaving that aside, why isn't this case, let's call it the apotheosis of waiver? Here comes the accused. I want a PTA. Here's this PTA. I offer this PTA. SJA says, okay. Convening authority says, okay. Goes into court. Says, I plead. Judge says, you understand that the terminal element is involved. Explains the terminal element to it. Said, yes, sir, yes, sir. Bang. End of story.
Potentially, Your Honor, yes, I would agree with that. However, those facts are different than our facts, seeing that the theories of liability didn't come up until after the plea. And from what I understand from your scenario is that the military judge explained it before the plea, which would be more consistent with Wilkins as opposed to this case.
Did he not agree that he violated the terminal element? Did the judge not explain it to him?
Not until after the plea.
Well, isn't that the normal course of things?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Yes, Your Honor. How do you plead? I plead guilty. Okay. Do you understand these are the elements of the offense? Now, do you still want to plead guilty? Yes, sir. Yes, sir. How isn't that total and absolute knowing waiver? Advised by counsel, no allegation of IAC. How isn't that total and absolute waiver?
Well, under United States versus Medina, as I previously argued, that the military judge and the charge sheet or the charge sheet must provide adequate notice of alternative theory of liability and the new charge. And in this case, the accused didn't realize that there was a new charge before the court and also didn't really realize, I mean, while the stip merely passively talks about the terminal elements, there was no real discussion until we got to the provenance.
What's the prejudice of them? I mean, I understand your allegation of error, right? Unless they finally agree with you, it was error to do it the way that it was done, as based on the laws it is today. How is your client prejudiced? I mean, what allegation is there that anything would have happened any differently, or that he would have been better off, or that he's somehow worse off, based on the pretrial agreement and the stipulation of fact and the provenance inquiry, than he would have otherwise been?
Yes, Your Honor. It's the appellant's position that it's the government's burden to establish that there was no prejudice, but in this case, the appellant was prejudiced for three reasons. First, he was convicted of an offense not charged, which is materially prejudiced.
Let's just assume for sake of argument that that's the error, not the prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor. Second was the fact that he pled guilty not to the LIO, the actual LIO, which would have been assault consummated by a battery, so the prejudice is the difference of a five-year time in the brig as far as the max confinement time.
Well, let's assume there that but for this, pleading to this LIO, that he would have been left exposed to the actual charge on the charge sheet, which was rape.
Yes, Your Honor.
You don't have any evidence to show that that's not the case, do you?
The third reason why he was prejudiced is the fact that because his plea wasn't knowing and voluntary in the sense that the charge was new before the court and he
but not knowing and voluntary in terms of he did know and voluntarily agree and admit to each of the elements of the offense to which the court martial found him guilty, correct?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, but more of
and he did include his acknowledgement of why he was guilty of all those facts and elements in the stipulation of that, right?
Yes, Your Honor. It's more to the fact that he didn't realize what was being charged, and that adversely affected his bargaining power vis-a-vis the convening authority. It's potentially, if he would have known that a new charge was before the court, he could have invoked his five-day waiting period and also the Article 32 hearing.
Would there have been anything to stop the convening authority if the appellant realized what you now say he did not realize and suddenly realized and said, wait a minute, hold everything. I'm withdrawing from my pretrial agreement because this, in fact, is not an LIO of the offense charge. Would there have been anything at that time that would have kept the convening authority as a matter of law, withdrawing the charge sheet and re-preferring it with the a listed Article 134 LIO?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I was kind of confused by your question. Do you mind repeating it?
No. Let's say that at the time that the plea agreement, instead of things progressing as they actually did, instead defense counsel suddenly foresaw the future and said, wait a minute, this is not, in fact, an LIO or a rape of a child, right? And would there have been anything, so I'm not going to, I've changed my mind, I'm not going to plead guilty to that Article 134 offense. Would there have been anything at that point in time as a matter of law that would have precluded the convening authority from saying, well, I want that as an LIO, from then withdrawing the charge sheet and referring it with a listed Article 134 offense?
No, Your Honor. No, that would have solved the error, potentially. But that's not what occurred in this case.
No, I understand it. I was just asking as a hypothetical matter whether there was anything, if facts had unfolded otherwise, whether basically would your client have been in any different position necessarily if we'd objected at the time on the basis that it was an LIO?
Well, in answering that question, I'm assuming that the terminal elements were either discussed, whether there's a new charge sheet, or the military judge said, okay, there's a new charge before you. Here's the terminal elements. Do you still plan on pleading guilty? Then that would there would be no prejudice in that case, and that would be a different case than what happened here. Something we haven't discussed was waiver, which is kind of the center of the specified issue.
I think we did, but please discuss it some more.
Before we get to that, unless you have further questions on that.
No, I don't. Go ahead.
If the pretrial agreement, instead of using guilty to the lesser included offense of indecent acts with a child, had simply said guilty to the offense of indecent acts with a child, would that be a problem?
Can you repeat that again?
If the pretrial agreement had been an agreement to plead guilty to the offense of indecent acts with a child,
so
where would we be?
You would be reading out the LIO language, is that?
Reading out the phrase lesser included offense. If that was the pretrial agreement signed by the parties to this case, and Providency Inquiry went exactly as it went here, but without reference to the phrase LIO, where would we be?
Well, Your Honor, it seems like under that scenario that this case would be more like Wilkins. However, what I've gleaned from the Wilkins opinion is that all the elements were discussed in the pretrial agreement. And under the example that you've given me, we still have the fair notice under Medina that he wouldn't have notice of the alternative theories of liability, but he would have notice of the new charge before the court.
Where is there a requirement that the convening authority refer to any elements in referring a case to trial? That is, if a convening authority refers a specification of any charge, he or she makes no mention of the elements in the referral, and the specification is defective in many respects. Is there a problem there if the specification is amended at trial? Where is there a requirement that the convening authority place any elements in the referral for purposes of the convening authority's action?
Well, the convening authority does write the charge sheet, Your Honor, and I think the way to answer your question is that the convening authority has to put the elements in to the charge sheet. Now, we understand that the pretrial agreement could constructively change the charge sheet, but you would still have to have the elements to whatever the crime is. If there's a new crime, if it's X, then those elements would have to be in the pretrial agreement.
But if the elements are defective in the charge sheet, they can be corrected at trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
And do those corrections have to be reflected in the physical act of altering the charge sheet, or can they be corrected for purposes of determining whether there's any prejudice in the case through instructions in a contested case or through the plea inquiry in a guilty plea case?
Well, it would seem that the change would have to occur before the plea, which was consistent with the error in this case, the fact that there was an amendment to the charge sheet and the accused forfeited as opposed to waived, which is consistent with United States v. Garrard, footnote 4. But there's no case law that I can think of where a defective plea can be fixed through the providency inquiry. It seems like Medina, Miller, Jones are clear that that has to occur before the plea and not after the plea.
Why isn't it enough that the errors be corrected before the plea is accepted? Isn't that the whole purpose of the plea inquiry? I mean, here he pleads guilty, and the military judge said, okay, before I accept your plea, I want to understand, I want to discuss this with you and make sure we both understand what's going on. So isn't the key really the acceptance of the plea rather than the plea itself?
Well, potentially, Your Honor, but in this case, there's two errors. There's several other errors, but there's two errors dealing with this assignment of error. There's the error that he didn't know what was actually being charged, and then also the alternative theories of liability.
Well, he didn't know the LIO aspects, but he knew pretty much everything else, wouldn't you say?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, he didn't realize that a new charge was before the court.
I mean, when you talk about alternative theories of liability, I mean, this was a case where the theory of liability of which he was convicted was explained to him in detail in the course of the providence inquiry, wasn't it? I mean, this isn't a case like Morton where the CCA changed the theory of liability on appeal, right? I mean, this is different than that case.
Yes, Your Honor. Which I read Morton kind of similar to Medina, and we do understand that our facts are different. It seems like the military judge changed the charge, and the accused wasn't on notice that there was a new charge before the court.
He was on notice of all the elements of the charge to which he pled, was he not?
Through the stipulation of fact.
Through the stipulation of fact in the care inquiry.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, including the terminal element.
Yes, Your Honor, but
And the judge went through all that, and he pled, and the judge found his plea to be provident.
Yes, Your Honor, but okay. In this case,
What's missing?
Well, the stip of fact was signed the day of the guilty plea. I mean, this was a contested trial. We know on page 582 of the record, the parties just finished voir dire and challenges. For the next 18 pages, they're discussing the Crawford issue and also a potential discovery issue. The parties break on a Friday, and then on page 600, he pleads guilty, and the stipulation of fact is signed that same day. And like I said before, there was only one sentence dealing with that. And the error in this case is that the accused didn't realize that there was a new charge before the court. And as far as this court's case law, it doesn't. There's no opinion that I can go to that says that that notice can be fixed on providency. But if this court wants to hold that as an opinion, it may, of course. I see that my time has run out. May I quickly conclude?
You may, for the record.
This court should set aside the finding of the sole specification of charge one because this record of trial fails to establish waiver. Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Judge Baker, judges of the court, may it please the court, Captain Sam Warren along with Colonel Brubaker. I represent the government in this case. This court should affirm this case for three reasons. First, there is no error in the referral or in the charge and specification of charge one. Second, any irregularity was waived by appellant's unconditional guilty plea. And third, if this court does find that there was error that was not waived, there is certainly no plain error in this case. Now, this analysis applies to two discrete issues that we have here. First, the referral issue, and second, whether what was referred was stated in defense. First, the referral. There's no error here because all that's required is a competent authority, which is the convening authority, to refer the charge to a court-martial. Here, that was done. The form of the order, as this court noted in Wilkins, is not jurisdictional, but that order is jurisdictional. That was
a counsel, I think you're discussing two separate issues that you telescope together. One's jurisdiction, one whether there's an error in the referral. You can have an error in the referral that's not jurisdictional. And do you disagree with the view that the defense had in the colloquy I had with the defense? Defense view is that there's error if the convening authority refers a specification that is defective. It may not be jurisdictional, but it's still an error.
Yes, Your Honor, as to whether the charge and specification states in
sentence. Was the charge of which he was convicted, was that referred to trial, expressly referred?
Through the pretrial agreement, yes, Your Honor. And that's
But the convening authority didn't initially refer that to trial.
No, Your Honor. Initially, the convening authority referred the Article 120 offense and its attendant lesser.
And the pretrial agreement contained no elements in it. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. What it did change is it said two things beyond. It did not change the language of the specification. The two things that it did change is instead of an Article 120 offense, we now have an Article 134 offense expressly in the pretrial agreement.
And so we never have before the court-martial the charge on which he was convicted until there's a finding. So why isn't that an error, which we then test for prejudice, as opposed to the argument you're making now that there's no error?
No error first is on the jurisdictional issue. Okay. There's jurisdiction here that was referred to this court-martial. But on to whether it states an offense and whether there's error in that case. This court, under the reading of maximum liberality, because there was no objection to trial here, the government submits that there is no error in the charge specification. Because you still do have the charge that was referred to this court, and you have that language that was added from the pretrial agreement, which added both Article 134 and indecent acts with a child.
I'm still having trouble following. Under those doctrines, why aren't those doctrines of assessing prejudice as opposed to determining whether there's error? What case do we have that stands for the proposition that it's permissible to have a charge before a court-martial that's defective?
We can look at Wilkins first of all, and once again, separating referral issues from whether it states an offense, and that necessitates a separate question.
Well, counsel, but the problem isn't whether it states an offense. It states an offense, right? No one's, I don't think, suggesting that this charge and specification don't state offenses. I think that the argument is that the offenses that they state and describe are different than the one that they're not pleaded guilty to and was found guilty of.
The original charge that was referred by the community authority is different from what he pleaded to.
So what case do you have that stands for the proposition that it's not error, okay, to convict someone of an Article 134 offense when they were charged with an Article 120 offense when the Article 120 offense doesn't contain the terminal elements? Does that make it more clear what we're asking?
Yes, Your Honor, and I apologize for not understanding the question.
Judge Ryan's asked the question much clearer than I did.
The proposition, and the only way that this could not be error in it to begin with, is under maximum liberality reading. Without that, certainly there's error.
Okay, and for maximum liberality, don't you have to have something to liberally construe as opposed to nothing that you would have to then make up or imply?
Yes, Your Honor. We still have the charge that's on the charge, and that was repeated in the pretrial agreement. And looking at that charge, which originally alleged the rape of the child, we still have that time, date, specific allegations, offense on there, with the added language of indecent acts with a child. With that, with maximum liberality, the government submits there is no error. But if this court does find that there is error in that.
You would agree that there's no language about prejudicial good order discipline or service discredit?
Expressed in there.
And so in order for us to find those elements, we would need to imply them, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't that what we just got done getting rid of in Miller and Jones and all those cases?
Those cases, and most recently, obviously, in Foster, are dealing with objections. Foster specifically dealing with an objection trial and the narrow reading of the charge and specification. The government submits that with a maximum liberality reading of that, it would be a different outcome. Nonetheless, even if there is error, the government submits that that error was waived by appellant's unconditional guilty plea in this case.
Do you think that your stronger argument is that we maximally liberally construe something out of thin air or that there's no prejudice?
Certainly, the stronger argument, Your Honor, is that it was waived, and if not waived, there is no plain error. So the government submits that if error in the charge specification, that was waived by appellant's unconditional guilty plea. In line with Bradley, where this court stated that an unconditional plea of guilty waives all non-jurisdictional defects at earlier stages of the proceedings. This also follows Wilkins, the same type holding where that unconditional guilty plea waive the error in the charge and specification. Nonetheless, if this court finds that there is error that is not waived in the charge and specification, it is subject to a plain error analysis due to the lack of objection in this case.
Counsel, do you agree that despite the language about unconditional guilty pleas, that when we're talking about constitutional rights of constitutional dimension, that the ordinary rule is that the waiver needs to be clear and unequivocal?
Yes, Your Honor, that is what this court has certainly held, that constitutional issues, there's a presumption against the waiver in those cases. Here, with the change in the law, which was at a minimum in flux after Miller and Medina, the government submits that through this guilty plea that this issue was waived by appellant's unconditional guilty plea in this case. Nonetheless, if not, it is subject to plain error analysis. Due to the change in the law, that is why the government submits that it was not plain and obvious, should not be found to be plain and obvious under that second prong. And even if so, certainly no prejudice in this case, where you have an appellant pleading guilty through with a guilty pretrial agreement, with the elements being explained, with the stipulation of fact, with the every actual notice that could be provided was provided here. So no prejudice to appellant under the third prong of plain error analysis under these facts and the circumstances. If this court does reach that plain error analysis, the government certainly submits as well that the fourth prong of the Supreme Court's precedent should be applied in that analysis. The government submits that that is the plain error test, that is the Supreme Court's binding precedent, and really it's the heart of
binding precedent? How could that be binding precedent when it interprets a federal rule of criminal procedure which uses language that is not found in the Uniform Code of Military Justice?
Your Honor, the language that's used in the federal rules of criminal procedure are not substantially different from what we have in the UCMJ, but more importantly, the fourth
if it's not substantially different, is it the government's view that we should now apply that as our standard under Article 59, that from now on, anything that simply affects rights plus a little bit more should be used to reverse convictions?
Your Honor, in the service courts, they're certainly bound by 66C and by the language of 59A.
And hasn't this court viewed Article 59A as a substantial hurdle for the accused to overcome
in order
to gain reversal of a conviction?
Yes, Your Honor, it is slightly heightened compared to federal
counsel. Only slightly heightened?
The material prejudice, the language of it, yes, Your Honor, goes to the material prejudice of substantial.
So that's the way the government would like us to apply Article 59 in the future, that it's only slightly different from Rule of Criminal Procedure 52B.
The government submits, and if I did not mean to mislead differently, the government submits that 59A can be applied as it is now, but when applying plain error in the military justice system, the fourth prong should be applicable as well. Because the fourth prong is the heart of the plain error analysis.
The fourth prong, as the Supreme Court indicated in Olano, was added because if you relied solely on the third prong, which is taken from Criminal Rule 52, the plain error rule would be eviscerated. That is, everything that touched upon someone's rights would be grounds for reversal. And that's why the fourth prong was added. Is the fourth prong needed in the military justice system where there's the express Article 66 requirement that you only reverse if there's material prejudice to substantial rights?
Your Honor, the government submits that it is because in line, the fourth prong was not new to Olano. It was newly added there, but it's not a new idea. It goes back to, you can look to Young and Atkinson, back to the early days of the last century. It is the heart of the analysis, which is kind of modifying the harsh reality of the contemporary subjection rule. And so they started that rule, say, if you come before this court and you can show, even if you did not object, but you can show some fundamental unfairness would result, then we will take action in that case.
So it's the government's view that if there's an error that materially affects the substantial rights of an accused, that the conviction will nonetheless be affirmed.
If it is not, it requires a lack of objection for trial first.
Right. That's where we would be in plain error otherwise. Can you give me an example of an error that would materially affect the substantial rights of an accused, which would not require a reversal?
You know, I believe if looking back to recent opinions by this court, as example only, such as Gerard McMurray, I believe those are cases which the errors, as this court held, affected the substantial right of the accused, but in the interest of fundamental fairness, looking at the totality of the facts and circumstances in this case, the government submits that under the fourth prong, it would not need to be reversed, because in those cases, they had actual notice of the lesser included offense, actual notice of all the elements, and when they come and are convicted of those offenses, the government submits that that would not result in fundamental unfairness in those cases.
So we should disregard Article 59?
No, no, no. It should not be disregarded.
Counsel, just to make sure that you understand what I think Judge Evron's point is, for example, in the federal system, if someone after the Apprendi line of cases, well, their case was still pending on direct review, went and alleged that there was an error based on Apprendi because the drug amount wasn't alleged in the indictment. Okay. In the federal system, I believe that they would analyze that aspect under the fourth prong of Milano, and they would look at things such as, did the appellant ever contest that that was the amount of drugs at issue, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How is that any different from what this court would do when analyzing substantial prejudice and substantial rights under the prejudice prong?
Yes, and that's Cotton, exactly, where you look at the post-Apprendi world, you say no objection to trial, let's apply a plain error analysis. And they do, they point out all the prongs, but they jump straight in many of the recent cases to the fourth prong. And they say, looking at this as a whole, maybe error, maybe plain and obvious, and maybe prejudicing some right. But in these circumstances, with the overwhelming amount of evidence, and that's something that would not be brought in now prong three, but based on the overwhelming evidence, the appellant's maybe an actual notice may come into play, maybe guilty plea may come into play. Based on all of that, there's no question of the fundamental nature, fundamental fairness of this trial, and therefore it should be upheld.
But I think that what Judge Efron is getting at isn't that what this court does when it's looking at prong three of plain error analysis, in determining whether there's prejudice or substantial rights being breached. Aren't those exactly the sort of questions that we get at under that third prong?
They're similar, Your Honor, but they're not to the same robust extent, and that's the heart of the government's argument on that prong. Nonetheless, the fourth prong is not needed for the government's case, to uphold this case, but the government submits a good plain error that prong should be included as part of the analysis. So here we have the referral. There's no jurisdiction of defects. We have a charge specification. If this court does find it's error and does not find that it's waiver, there's certainly no prejudice in the third prong of plain error analysis. If there are no further questions, that concludes the government's argument.
Thank you very much, counsel. Opportunity for rebuttal.
There's a heavy presumption against waiving constitutional rights. In order to overcome this presumption, the government's going to have to clearly establish that the appellant intentionally relinquished a known right. Here, the government has failed to meet their burden because the appellant was wrong about the law, just like the convening authority. And how could he not have been wrong about the law? His trial defense attorney and also the military judge were also wrong about the law. Notably, on this record there, on page 471 of the record, the military judge did amend a different charge not associated with this assignment. And the accused waived the amendment to the charge. But here, this record of trial has failed to establish waiver because there's no discussion whatsoever about waiving these constitutional rights dealing with this appeal or this.
Could you be, is your prejudice argument that you provided earlier, is that based on Jones or Fosler? Or both, I guess, but if so, clarify.
Do you mean my...
Is your prejudice derived from the CA's confusion about what an LIO is, or is your prejudice derived from the fact that the terminal elements were not stated?
Well, both, Your Honor, is your question in regards to the
you said earlier that the prejudice was he pled guilty to something that was not an actual LIO. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
That's your main prejudice argument?
Yes, sir.
And is that derived from Fosler or Jones, just to be clear?
I'm not familiar with Fosler. You didn't say
that answers the question. Fosler being the terminal elements case. I'm happy if you're happy.
If I can add on to Chief Judge Baker's question, assuming that the two different prongs of prejudice, what Judge Baker just described as prejudice or your description of prejudice, if others view that as the error, not rather than the prejudice, what specific prejudice did your client face based on the errors in, by the convening authority?
Well, first,
how was he worse off as a practical matter than he would have otherwise been?
He was harmed
in a practical sense, as opposed to there was an error.
But he was harmed in the sense that he pled guilty to the wrong offense. He should have gone to the actual LIO, unless the convening authority actually referred a new charge, which in this case it's the appellant's position that he didn't. And then also, vis-a-vis the convening authority, he was in a worse position as far as his negotiation position. If he would have known it was a new charge, he could have invoked his rights to the 5-day waiting period and also the Article 32 hearing, which would have helped out his...
And the actual LIO gave him a better sentence exposure.
And that's
your argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so that's derived from Jones and then not Fossil?
Yes, Your Honor.
You've answered my question. Are you happy to? Okay. You get to summarize since we jumped in there and gave you a hard time, so...
This court should dismiss charge one because the record of trial fails to establish error. Or waiver. Thank you.
The court thanks both counsel. The case is submitted, and we stand in recess until further order of the court.
Court stands adjourned.